Touring with the Alien by Carolyn Ives Gilman. Narrated by Elizabeth Liang.
The alien spaceships were beautiful. No one could deny that. Towering domes of overlapping chitinous plates in pearly dawn colors, like reflections on a tranquil sea. They appeared overnight, a dozen incongruous soap bubble structures scattered across the North American continent. One of them blocked a major interstate in Ohio. Another monopolized a stadium parking lot in Tulsa. But most stood in cornfields and forests and deserts where they caused little inconvenience. Everyone called them spaceships, but from the beginning the experts questioned that name. NORAD had recorded no incoming landing craft, and no mothership orbited above. That left two main possibilities. They were visitations from an alien race that traveled by some incomprehensibly advanced method, or they were a mutant eruption of Earth's own tortured ecosystem. The domes were impervious. Probing radiation bounced off them, as did potshots from locals in the days before the military moved in to cordon off the areas. Attempts to communicate produced no reaction. All the domes did was sit there reflecting the sky in luminous, dreaming colors. 6 months later, the panic had subsided, and even CNN had grown weary of reporting breaking news that was just the same old news. Then, entry panels began to open and out walked the translators, one per dome. They were perfectly ordinary-looking human beings who said that they had been abducted as children and had now come back to interpret between their biological race and the people who had adopted them. Humanity learned surprisingly little from the translators. The aliens had come in peace. They had no demands and no questions. They merely wanted to sit here minding their own business for a while. They wanted to be left alone. No one believed it. Avery was visiting her brother when her boss called.
"Say, you still got those security credentials, right?" Frank said.
"Yes." She had gotten the security clearance in order to haul a hush-hush load of nuclear fuel to Nevada, a feat she wasn't keen on repeating.
"And you're in D.C.?"
She was actually in Northern Virginia, but close enough.
"Yeah. I've got a job for you."
"Don't tell me it's another gig for those we dare not name." He didn't laugh, which told her it was bad.
No, more like those we can't name."
She didn't get it.
"What?"
"Some neighbors who live in funny-shaped houses. I can't say more over the phone." She got it then.
"Frank, you took a contract from the frigging aliens?"
"Shh," he said, as if every phone in America weren't bugged. "It's strictly confidential."
"Jesus,"
she breathed out. She had done some crazy things for Frank, but this was over the top.
"When? Where? What?"
"Leaving tonight. D.C. to St. Louis. A converted tour bus."
"Tour bus? How many of them are going?"
"Two passengers. One human, one whatever. Will you do it?" She looked into the immaculate condo living room, where her brother, Blake, and his husband, Jeff, were playing a noisy, fast-paced video game, oblivious to her conversation. She had promised to be at Blake's concert tomorrow. It meant a lot to him.
"Just a second," she said to Frank.
"I can't wait,"
he said. "2 seconds." She muted the phone and walked into the living room. Blake saw her expression and paused the game. She said,
"Would you hate me if I couldn't be there tomorrow?"
Disappointment, resignation, and wry acceptance crossed his face, as if he hadn't ever really expected her to keep her promise.
"What is it?" he asked.
"A job," she said. "A really important job. Never mind, I'll turn it down."
"No, Ave, don't worry. There will be other concerts." Still, she hesitated.
"You sure?"
she said. She and Blake had always hung together like castaways on a hostile sea. They had given each other courage to sail into the wind. To disappoint him felt disloyal.
"Go ahead," he said. "Now I'll be sorry if you stay."
She thumbed the phone on.
"Okay, Frank, I'll do it. This better not get me in trouble."
"Cross my heart and hope to die," he said. "I'll email you instructions. Bye."
From the couch, Jeff said, "Now I know why you want to do it, because it's likely to get you in trouble."
"No, he gave me his word," Avery said.
"Cowboy Frank? The one who had you drive guns to Nicaragua?"
"That was perfectly legal," Avery said.
Jeff had a point, as usual. Specialty shipping did the jobs no reputable company would handle. Ergo, so did Avery.
"What is it this time?" Blake asked.
"I can't say."
The email had come through.
Frank had attached the instructions as if a PDF were more secure than email. She opened and scanned them. The job had been cleared by the government, but the client was the alien passenger, and she was to take orders only from him within the law. She scanned the rest of the instructions till she saw the pickup time. "Damn, I've got to get going," she said. Her brother followed her into the guest room to watch her pack up. He had never understood her nomadic lifestyle, which made his silent support for it all the more generous. She was compelled to wander. He was rooted in this home, this relationship, this warm, supportive community. She was a discarder, using things up and throwing them away. He had created a home that was a visual expression of himself, from the spare Japanese-style furniture to the Zen colors on the walls. Visiting him was like living inside a beautiful soul. She had no idea how they could have grown up so different. It was as if they were foundlings. She pulled on her boots and shouldered her backpack. Blake hugged her. "Have a good trip," he said. "Call me." "Will do," she said, and hit the road again. The media had called the dome in Rock Creek Park the mothership, but only because of its proximity to the White House, not because it was in any way distinctive. Like the others, it had appeared overnight, sighted on a broad, grassy clearing that had been a secluded picnic ground in the urban park. It filled the entire creek valley, cutting off the trails and greatly inconveniencing the joggers and bikers. Avery was unprepared for its scale. Like most people, she had seen the domes only on TV, and the small screen did not do justice to the neck-craning reality. She leaned forward over the wheel and peered out the windshield as she brought the bus to a halt at the last checkpoint. The National Park Police pickup that had escorted her through all the other checkpoints pulled aside. The appearance of an alien habitat had set off a battle of jurisdictions in Washington. The dome stood on U.S. Park Service property, but D.C. police controlled all the access streets, and the U.S. Army was tasked with maintaining a perimeter around it. No agency wanted to surrender a particle of authority to the others. And then there was the polite, well-groomed young man who had introduced himself as Henry, now sitting in the passenger seat next to her. His neatly pressed suit sported no bulges of weaponry, but she assumed he was CIA. She now saw method in Frank's madness at calling her so spur of the moment. Her last-minute arrival had prevented anyone from pulling her aside into a cinderblock room for a briefing. Instead, Henry had accompanied her in the bus, chatting informally. "Say, while you're on the road..." "No," she said. "No?" "The alien's my client. I don't spy on clients." He paused a moment but seemed unruffled. "Not even for your country?" "If I think my country's in danger, I'll get in touch." "Fair enough," he said pleasantly. She hadn't expected him to give up so easily. He handed her a business card. "So you can get in touch," he said. She glanced at it. It said Henry with a phone number. No logo, no agency, no last name. She put it in a pocket. "I have to get out here," he said when the bus rolled to a halt 100 yards from the dome. "It's been nice meeting you, Avery." "Take your bug with you," she said.
"I beg your pardon?"
"The bug you left somewhere in this cab."
"There's no bug," he said seriously.
Since the bus was probably wired like a studio, she shrugged and resolved not to scratch anywhere embarrassing till she had a chance to search. As she closed the door behind Henry, the soldiers removed the roadblock and she eased the bus forward. It was almost evening, but floodlights came on as she approached the dome. She pulled the bus parallel to the wall and lowered the wheelchair lift. One of the hexagonal panels slid aside, revealing a stocky, dark-haired young man in black glasses, surrounded by packing crates of the same pearly substance as the dome. Avery started forward to help with loading, but he said tensely, "Stay where you are." She obeyed. He pushed the first crate forward, and it moved as if on wheels, though Avery could see none. It was slightly too wide for the lift, so the man put his hands on either side and pushed in. The crate reconfigured itself, growing taller and narrower, till it fit onto the platform. Avery activated the power lift. He wouldn't let Avery touch any of the crates, but insisted on stowing them himself at the back of the bus, where a private bedroom suite had once accommodated a touring celebrity singer. When the last crate was on, he came forward and said, "We can go now." "What about the other passenger?" Avery said. "He's here." She realized that the alien must have been in one of the crates, or, for all she knew, was one of the crates. "Okay," she said. "Where to?" Anywhere, he said, and turned to go back into the bedroom. Since she had no instructions to the contrary, Avery decided to head south. As she pulled out of the park, there was no police escort, no helicopter overhead, no obvious trailing car. The terms of this journey had been carefully negotiated at the highest levels, she knew. Their security was to be secrecy. No one was to know where they were. Avery's instructions from Frank had stressed that, aside from getting the alien safely where he wanted to go, ensuring his privacy was her top priority. She was not to pry into his business or allow anyone else to do so. Rush hour traffic delayed them a long time. At first, Avery concentrated on putting as much distance as she could between the bus and Washington. It was past 10 by the time she turned off the main roads. She activated the GPS to try and find a route, but all the screen showed was snow. She tried her phone, and the result was the same. Not even the radio worked. One of those crates must have contained a jamming device. The bus was a rolling electronic dead zone. She smiled. So much for Henry's bugs. It was quiet and peaceful driving through the night. A nearly full moon rode in the clear autumn sky, and woods closed in around them. Once, when she had first taken up driving in order to escape her memories, she had played a game of heading randomly down roads she had never seen, getting deliberately lost. Now she played it again, not caring where she ended up. She had never been good at keeping to the main roads. By 3 o'clock she was tired, and when she saw the entrance to a state park, she turned and pulled into the empty parking lot. In the quiet after the engine shut off, she walked back through the kitchen and sitting area to see if there were any objections from her passengers. She listened at the closed door, but heard nothing and concluded they were asleep. As she was turning away, the door jerked open and the translator said, "What do you want?" He was still fully dressed, exactly as she had seen him before, except without the glasses, his eyes were a little bloodshot, as if he hadn't closed them. "I've pulled over to get some sleep," she said. "It's not safe to keep driving without rest." "Oh, all right," he said, and closed the door. Shrugging, she went forward. There was a fold-down bunk that had once served the previous owner's entourage, and she now prepared to use it. She brushed her teeth in the tiny bathroom, pulled a sleeping bag from her backpack, and settled in. Morning sun woke her. When she opened her eyes, it was flooding in the windows. At the kitchen table a yard away from her, the translator was sitting, staring out the window. By daylight, she saw that he had a square face the color of teak and closely trimmed black beard. She guessed that he might be Latino and in his 20s. "Morning," she said. He turned to stare at her, but said nothing. Not practiced in social graces, she thought. "I'm Avery," she said. Still, he didn't reply. "It's customary to tell me your name now," she said. "Oh, Lionel," he answered. "Pleased to meet you." He said nothing, so she got up and went into the bathroom. When she came out, he was still staring fixedly out the window. She started making coffee. "Want some?" she asked.
"What is it?"
"Coffee."
"I ought to try it," he said reluctantly.
"Well, don't let me force you," she said.
"Why would you do that?"
He was studying her, apprehensive. "I wouldn't. I was being sarcastic. Like a joke, never mind."
"Oh."
He got up restlessly and started opening the cupboards. Frank had stocked them with all the necessities, even a few luxuries. But Lionel didn't seem to find what he was looking for. "Are you hungry?" Avery guessed.
"What do you mean?"
Avery searched for another way to word the question. "Would you like me to fix you some breakfast?" He looked utterly stumped. "Never mind, just sit down and I'll make you something." He sat down, gripping the edge of the table tensely.
"That's a tree," he said, looking out the window.
"Right, it's a whole lot of trees."
"I ought to go out."
She didn't make the mistake of joking again. It was like talking to a person raised by wolves, or aliens. When she set a plate of eggs and bacon down in front of him, he sniffed it suspiciously.
"That's food."
"Yes, it's good. Try it." He watched her eat for a few moments, then gingerly tried a bite of scrambled eggs. His expression showed distaste, but he resolutely forced himself to swallow. But when he tried the bacon, he couldn't bear it.
"It bit my mouth," he said.
"You're probably not used to the salt. What do you normally eat?" He reached in a pocket and took out some brown pellets that looked like dog kibble. Avery made a face of disgust. "What is that, people chow?" It's perfectly adapted to our nutritional needs, Lionel said. Try it. She was about to say, no thanks. But he was clearly making an effort to try new things, so she took a pellet and popped it in her mouth. It wasn't terrible, chewy rather than crunchy, but tasteless. I think I'll stick to our food, she said. He looked gloomy. I need to learn to eat yours. Why, research? He nodded. I have to find out how the feral humans live. So, Avery reflected, she was dealing with someone raised as a pet who was now being released into the wild, for whatever reason. So where do you want to go today? Avery said, sipping coffee. He gave an indifferent gesture. You're heading for St. Louis? Oh, I just picked that name off a map. It seemed to be in the center. That it is. She had lived there once. It was so incorrigibly in the center, there was no edge to it. Do you want to go by any particular route? He shrugged. How much time do you have? As long as it takes. Okay, the scenic route then. She got up to clean the dishes, telling Lionel that this was a good time for him to go out, if he wanted to. It took him a while to summon his resolve. She watched out the kitchen window as he approached a tree as if to have a conversation with it. He felt its bark, smelled its leaves, and returned unhappy and distracted. Avery followed the same random choice method of navigation as the previous night, but always trending west. Soon they came to the first ridge of mountains. People from western states talked as if the Appalachians weren't real mountains, but they were. Rugged and impenetrable ridges like walls erected to bar people from the land of milk and honey. In the mountains, all the roads ran northeast and southwest through the valleys between the crumpled land, with only the brave roads daring to climb up and pierce the ranges. The autumn leaves were at their height, russet and gold against the brilliant sky. All day long, Lionel sat staring out the window. That night, she found a half-deserted campground outside a small town. She refilled the water tanks, hooked up the electricity, then came back in. You're all set, she told Lionel. If it's all right with you, I'm heading into town. Okay, he said. It felt good to stretch her legs walking along the highway shoulder. The air was chill but bracing. The town was a tired, half-abandoned place, but she found a bar and settled down with a beer and a burger. She couldn't help watching the patrons around her, worn down, elderly people just managing to hang on. What would an alien think of America if she brought him here? Remembering that she was away from the interference field, she thumbed on her phone and immediately realized that the ping would give away her location to the spooks. But since she'd already done it, she dialed her brother's number and left a voicemail congratulating him on the concert she was missing. Everything's fine with me, she said, then added mischievously, I met a nice young man named Henry. I think he's sweet on me. Bye. Heading back through the night, she became aware that someone was following her. The highway was too dark to see who it was, but when she stopped, the footsteps behind her stopped too. At last, a car passed and she wheeled around to see what the headlights showed. Lionel! She shouted. He didn't answer, just stood there, so she walked back toward him. Did you follow me? He was standing with hands in pockets, hunched against the cold. Defensively, he said, I wanted to see what you would do when I wasn't around. It's none of your business what I do off-duty. Listen, respecting privacy goes both ways. If you want me to respect yours, you've got to respect mine, okay? He looked cold and miserable, so she said, Come on, let's get back before you freeze solid. They walked side by side in silence, gravel crunching underfoot. At last, he said stiffly, I'd like to renegotiate our contract. Oh, yeah? What part of the contract? The part about privacy. He searched for words. We should have asked for more than a driver. We need a translator. At least he'd realized it. He might speak perfect English, but he was not fluent in human. My contract is with your employer. Is this what he wants? Who? The other passenger. I don't know what to call him. The alien isn't polite. What's his name? They don't have names. They don't have a language. Astonished, Avery said, Then how do you communicate? He glowered at her. She held up her hands. Sorry, no offense intended. I'm just trying to find out what he wants. They don't want things, he muttered, gazing fixedly at the moonlit road. At least, not like you do. They're not awake.
aware, not like people are. This made so little sense to Avery, she wondered if he were having trouble with the language.
I don't understand, she said. You mean they're not sentient?
They're not conscious, he said. There's a difference.
But they have technology. They built those domes, or brought them here, or whatever the hell they did. They have an advanced civilization.
I didn't say they aren't smart. They're smarter than people are. They're just not conscious.
Avery shook her head. I'm sorry, I just can't imagine it.
Yes, you can,
Lionel said impatiently.
People function unconsciously all the time. You're not aware that you're keeping your balance right now. You just do it automatically. You don't have to be aware to walk or breathe. In fact, the more skillful you are at something, the less aware you are. Being aware would just degrade their skill.
They had come to the campground entrance. Behind the dark pine trees, Avery could see the bus, holding its unknowable passenger. For a moment, the bus seemed to stare back with blank eyes. She made herself focus on the practical.
So how can I know what he wants?
I'm telling you.
She refrained from asking, and how do you know, because he'd already refused to answer that. The new privacy rules were to be selective then. But she already knew more about the aliens than anyone else on Earth, except the translators. Not that she understood.
I'm sorry, I can't keep calling him or the alien, Avery said the next morning over breakfast. I have to give him a name. I'm going to call him Mr. Burbage. If he doesn't know, he won't mind.
Lionel didn't look any more disturbed than usual. She took that as consent.
So where are we going today? She asked.
He pressed his lips together in concentration.
I need to go to a place where I can acquire knowledge.
Since this could encompass anything from a brothel to a university, Avery said,
You've got to be more specific. What kind of knowledge?
Knowledge about you.
Me?
No, you humans. How you work.
Humans. For that, she would have to find a bigger town. As she cruised down a county road, Avery thought about Blake. Once, he had told her that to play an instrument truly well, you had to lose all awareness of what you were doing and rely entirely on the muscle memory in your fingers.
You are so in the present, there is no room for self, Blake said. No ego, no doubt, no introspection.
She envied him the ability to achieve such a state. She had tried to play the saxophone, but had never gotten good enough to experience what Blake described. Only playing video games could she concentrate intensely enough to lose self-awareness. It was strange how addictive it was to escape the prison of her skull and forget she had a self. Mystics and meditators strove to achieve such a state. A motion in the corner of her eye made her slam on the brakes and swerve. A startled deer pirouetted, flipped its tail, and leaped away. She continued on more slowly, searching for a sign to see where she was. She could not remember having driven the last miles, or whether she had passed any turns. Smiling grimly, she realized that driving was her skill, something she knew so well that she could do it unconsciously. She had even reacted to a threat before knowing what it was. Her reflexes were faster than her conscious mind. Were the aliens like that all the time? In a perpetual state of flow? Like virtuoso musicians or Zen monks in samadhi? What would be the point of achieving such supreme skill if the price was never knowing it was you doing it? Around noon, they came to a town nestled in a steep valley on a rushing river. Driving down the main street, she spied a quaint, cupolaed building with a municipal library sign out front. Farther on, at the edge of town, an abandoned car lot offered a grass-pocked parking lot, so she turned in.
Come on, Lionel, she called out. I found a place for you to acquire knowledge.
They walked back into town together. The library was quiet and empty except for an old man reading a magazine. The selection of books was sparse, but there was a row of computers.
You know how to use these? Avery said in a low voice.
Not this kind, Lionel said. They're very primitive.
They sat down together, and Avery explained how to work the mouse and get on the internet, how to search and scroll.
I've got it, he said. You can go now.
Shrugging, she left him to his research. She strolled down the main street, stopped in a drugstore, then found a cafe that offered fried egg sandwiches on Wonder Bread, a luxury from her childhood. With lunch and a cup of coffee, she settled down to wait, sorting email on her phone.
Sometime later, she became aware of the television behind the counter. It was tuned to one of those daytime exposé shows hosted by a shrill woman who spoke in a tone of breathless indignation. "Coming up," she said. "Slaves or traitors? Who are these alien translators?" Avery realized that some part of her brain must have been listening and alerted her conscious mind to pay attention, just as it had reacted to the deer. She had a threat detection system she was not even aware of. In the story that followed, a correspondent revealed that she had been unable to match any of the translators with missing children recorded in the past 20 years. The host treated this as suspicious information that someone ought to be looking into. Then came a panel of experts to discuss what they knew of the translators, which was nothing. "Turncoats," commented one of the men at the counter watching the show. "Why would anyone betray his own race?"
"They're not even human," said another. "Just made to look that way. They're clones or robots or something."
"The government won't do anything. They're just letting those aliens sit there." Avery got up to pay her bill. The woman at the cash register said,
"You connected with that big tour bus parked out at Fenneman's?"
She had forgotten that in a town like this, everyone knew instantly what was out of the ordinary.
"Yeah," Avery said. "Me and my boyfriend are delivering it to a new owner."
She glanced up at the television just as a collage of faces appeared. Lionel's was in the top row.
"Look closely," the show's host said. "If you recognize any of these faces, call us at 1-800.
Avery didn't wait to hear the number. The door shut behind her. It was hard not to walk quickly enough to attract attention. Why had she left him alone, as if it were safe? Briefly, she thought of bringing the bus in to pick him up at the library, but it would only attract more attention. The sensible thing was to slip inconspicuously out of town. Lionel was engrossed in a website about the brain when she came in. She sat down next to him and said quietly,
"We've got to leave."
"I'm not..."
"Lionel, we have to leave, right now."
He frowned but got the message. As he rose to put on his coat, she quickly erased his browser history and cache. Then she led the way out and around the building to a back street where there were fewer eyes.
"Hold my hand," she said.
"Why?"
"I told them you were my boyfriend. We've got to act friendly."
He didn't object or ask what was going on. The aliens had trained him well, she thought. The street they were on came to an end, and they were forced back onto the main thoroughfare right past the cafe. In Avery's mind, every window was a pair of eyes staring at the strangers. As they left the business section of town and the buildings thinned out, she became aware of someone walking a block behind them. Glancing back, she saw a man in hunter's camouflage and billed cap, carrying a gun case on a strap over one shoulder. She sped up, but the man trailing them sped up as well. When they were in sight of the bus, Avery pressed the keys into Lionel's hand and said,
"Go on ahead. I'll stall this guy. Get inside and don't open the door to anyone but me."
Then she turned back to confront their pursuit.
Familiarity tickled as he drew closer. When she was sure, she called out, "Afternoon, Henry. What a coincidence to see you here."
"Hello, Avery," he said.
He didn't look quite right in the hunter costume. He was too urban and fit.
"That was pretty careless of you. I followed to make sure you got back safe."
"I didn't know his picture was all over the TV," she said. "I've been out of touch."
"I know, we lost track of you for a while there. Please don't do that again."
As threats went, Henry now seemed like the lesser evil. She hesitated, then said,
"I didn't see any need to get in touch."
That meant the country was not in peril.
"Thanks," he said. "Listen, if you turn left on Highway 19 ahead, you'll come to a national park with a campground. It'll be safe."
As she walked back to the bus, she was composing a lie about who she had been talking to. But Lionel never asked. As soon as she was on board, he started eagerly telling her about what he had learned in the library. She had never seen him so animated, so she gestured him to sit in the passenger seat beside her while she got the bus moving again.
"The reason you're conscious is because of the cerebral cortex," he said. "It's an add-on, the last part of the brain to evolve. Its only purpose is to monitor what the rest of the brain is doing. All the sensory input goes to the inner brain first and gets processed, so the cortex never gets the raw data. It only sees the effect on the rest of the brain, not what's really out there. That's why you're aware of yourself. In fact, it's all you're aware of."
"Why are you saying you?" Avery asked. "You've got a cerebral cortex, too."
Defensively, he said, "I'm not like you."
Avery shrugged. Okay. But she wanted to keep the conversation going. So Mr. Burbage doesn't have a cortex? Is that what you're saying?
That's right, Lionel said. For him, life is a skill of the autonomic nervous system, not something he had to consciously learn. That's why he can think and react faster than we can and requires less energy. The messages don't have to travel on a useless detour through the cortex.
Useless, Avery objected. I kind of like being conscious.
Lionel fell silent, suddenly grave and troubled.
She glanced over at him. What's the matter?
In a low tone, he said, he likes being conscious too. It's what they want from us.
Avery gripped the wheel and tried not to react. Up to now, the translators had denied that the aliens wanted anything at all from humans. But then it occurred to her that Lionel might not mean humans when he said us.
You mean you translators? She ventured.
He nodded, looking grim.
Is that a bad thing? She asked, reacting to his expression.
Not for us, he said. It's bad for them. It's killing him.
He was struggling with some strong emotion. Guilt, she thought. Maybe grief. I'm sorry, she said.
Angrily, he stood up to head back into the bus. Why do you make me think of this? He said. Why can't you just mind your own business?
Avery drove on, listening as he slammed the bedroom door behind him. She didn't feel any resentment. She knew all about guilt and grief, and how useless they made you feel. Lionel's behavior made more sense to her now. He was having trouble distinguishing between what was happening to him externally and what was coming from inside. Even people skilled at being human had trouble with that. The national park Henry had recommended turned out to be at Cumberland Gap, the mountain pass early pioneers had used to migrate west to Kentucky. They spent the night in the campground undisturbed. At dawn, Avery strolled out in the damp morning air to look around. She quickly returned to say, Lionel, come out here. You need to see this. She led him across the road to an overlook facing west. From the edge of the Appalachians, they looked out on range after range of wooded foothills swaddled in fog. The morning sun at their backs lit everything in shades of mauve and azure. Avery felt like Daniel Boone looking out on the promised land, stretching before her into the misty distance, unpolluted by the past.
I find this pleasant, Lionel said gravely.
Avery smiled. It was a breakthrough statement for someone so unaccustomed to introspection that he hadn't been able to tell her he was hungry 2 days ago. But all she said was, Me too. After several moments of silence, she ventured, Don't you think Mr. Burbage would enjoy seeing this? There's no one else around. Doesn't he want to get out of the bus sometime?
He is seeing it, Lionel said.
What do you mean?
He is here. Lionel tapped his head with a finger. Avery couldn't help staring.
You mean you have some sort of telepathic connection with him?
There's no such thing as telepathy, Lionel said dismissively. They communicate with neurotransmitters.
She was still waiting, so he said, He doesn't have to be all in one place. Part of him is with me. Part of him is in the bus.
In your head? She asked, trying not to betray how creepy she found this news.
He nodded. He needs me to observe the world for him and understand it. They have had lots of other helper species to do things for them, species that build things or transport them, but we're the first one with advanced consciousness.
And that's why they're interested in us?
Lionel looked away to avoid her eyes, but nodded.
They like it, he said, his voice low and reluctant. At first it was just novel and new for them, but now it's become an addiction, like a dangerous drug. We pay a high metabolic price for consciousness. It's why our lifespan is so short. They live for centuries. But when they get hooked on us, they burn out even faster than we do.
He picked up a rock and flung it over the cliff, watching as it arced up, then plummeted. And if he dies, what happens to you? Avery asked.
I don't want him to die, Lionel said.
He put his hands in his pockets and studied his feet.
It feels good to have him around. I like his company. He's very old, very wise.
For a moment, she could see it through his eyes. She could imagine feeling intimately connected to an ancient being who was dying from an inability to part with his adopted human son. What a terrible burden for Lionel to carry, to be slowly killing someone he loved. And yet, she still felt uneasy. How do you know? She asked. He looked confused.
What do you mean?
You said he's old and wise. How do you know that?
The way you know anything unconscious, it's a feeling, an instinct.
Are you sure he's not controlling you? Pushing around your neurotransmitters?
That's absurd, he said, mildly irritated. I told you he's not conscious, at least not naturally. Control is a conscious thing.
But what if you did something he didn't want?
I don't feel like doing things he doesn't want, like talking to you now. He must have decided he can trust you because I wouldn't feel like telling you anything if he hadn't.
Avery wasn't sure whether being trusted by an alien was something she aspired to, but she did want Lionel to trust her, and so she let the subject drop. Where do you want to go today? She asked.
You keep asking me that.
He stared out on the landscape as if waiting for a revelation. At last he said,
I want to see humans living as they normally do. We've barely seen any of them. I didn't think the planet was so sparsely populated.
Okay, she said. I'm going to have to make a phone call for that. When he had returned to the bus, she strolled away, took out Henry's card, and thumbed the number. Despite the early hour, he answered on the first ring. He wants to see humans, she said. Normal humans behaving normally. Can you help me out?
Let me make some calls, he said. I'll text you instructions.
No men in black, she said. You know what I mean?
I get it.